Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a special edition of Podcasts for Good. My name is Philip Kerrigan. I'm the program manager of the Washington State Combined Fund Drive, and this is, as always,
Heather Lucas, the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Combined Fund Drive.
We are here with some very special guests from Legacy Washington. This is actually kind of cool because not only are the folks from Legacy Washington in the Community Programs Division, which is where the Combined Fund Drive is housed, but they also are a member charity in the CFD. So what we'll do first is we'll go around the room, starting over here with John. Introduce yourselves, your title, and I guess how long you've been working for Legacy.
I'm John Hughes. I'm the chief historian for Legacy Washington, and I've been here for 10 years.
Excellent.
I'm Lori Larson. I'm the senior researcher, but I wear many hats.
Yes.
And I've been here for 15 years.
Awesome.
Hi, I'm Bob Young. I'm a historian with Legacy Washington, and I've been here 6 months.
His probation's up.
Oh, is it really?
We're keeping him.
So he's not fired based on
not
this
at
podcast?
All, no.
His performance today will not get him fired?
I mean, I can take my pants off over
no,
my head.
No.
That's the next podcast. So what we're talking about today is what Legacy Washington is for folks who don't know. And then also what we're doing is talking about your new exhibit, which is an expose on 1968. It's kind of a perfect time because it's the 50th anniversary, and I'm sure we'll get into it. There are some parallels between then and now. The first thing we're going to ask, though, is what exactly Legacy Washington is. Lori, can you talk a little bit about Legacy Washington, what it does, and what its role is within the Secretary of State?
Yeah, so we are a small but mighty program of five people.
And yes, indeed.
We're a storytelling arm of Secretary of State's office. We have the State Library and the State Archives within our agency. Mm-hmm. So we have the ability to tap amazing resources of one-of-a-kind Washington State documents and photographs just right at our fingertips. And we bring them to life through the humans who lived these events in Washington State history. We focus on everyone from governors to congressmen and women, justices, and really anyone who participated in the political life in Washington and made a difference.
And Washingtonians mostly, right?
Yes, that is our focus.
Awesome. All right, so of all the years and the themes, why did you guys select this theme, 1968, the year that rocked Washington, as this year's theme?
Well, for starters, it's 50 years on. Uh-huh. And above all, we came up with a theme, the year that rocked Washington. Time Magazine, a lot of others, PBS have done retrospectives on 1968, mm-hmm. called it the year that changed the world, the year that shocked the world. And there's a strong rock and roll component in mm-hmm, all this. Mm-hmm. Bob Young and I really grew up with the music of that era, starting with Jimi Hendrix. So we came up with the year that rocked Washington. But you'd be hard put to find a year more cataclysmic in Washington State international history. Begins with the Tet Offensive, the Viet Cong and Vietnamese regulars stage a massive Lunar New Year invasion. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about that is that in the end, by April, they really weren't winning, but they'd won the public relations war, and it was a huge setback for President Johnson, who was very much challenged in the New Hampshire primary and came in, won it, but came didn't make much of a showing. And so then starting in April, in the next 10 weeks, we have the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy. And then after that comes summer, the riots at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Right, right. I mean, basically, it's one of the most... It's one of the craziest 12-month spans in American history, or at least recent American history.
A kid said to me the other day, gee, Mr. Hughes, you were actually alive in 1968. And I was. I was a 25-year-old political writer covering a lot of the elections. But it seems so vivid to me, even now. I can hear Robert F. Kennedy's words standing on a flatbed truck talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King.
One of the coolest speeches ever.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort.
Well, it was pretty amazing. In his a white man looking out at a shocked black audience, you could hear just the gasps, the crying, the weeping, and he looked out and said, and I know about this because my brother was killed by a white man.
Yes.
I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man.
Yeah. I've got goose flesh now thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's really like that particular speech is one of those where you feel like that crowd is pretty prepared to break things and riot. And then he managed to basically chill that crowd out, really, by that one line. It was really neat.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another.
And what about you, Bob? What made 1968 such a compelling idea?
Well, I would just note that the changes were also global. I mean, mm-hmm. we had student riots in streets of Paris, in Czechoslovakia, democracy movement briefly took over. In Mexico City, hundreds of students were slain in a protest just before the Olympics. This was a global fire, it seemed like, that was spreading around the country. And then here in Washington, we had our share of notable events as well. And in particular, we had a black student, a black power movement, and Black Student Union was created at the UW. They came to occupy the president's office with a series of demands that related to more minority students, more minority faculty, and those demands were accepted eventually by the president of the university. Mm-hmm. We had a famous, perhaps the first student sit-in at Franklin High that had repercussions in that it probably led to the creation of the first Black Panther chapter outside of California was created here in Seattle. And just so, and on and on, we can talk more about the local ripples.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, Lori, when the idea is being talked about, and you are not alive in 1968, right? What was it about that particular conversation that made you, as a person who wasn't even around then, actually think it was a good idea?
Oh my goodness. I have been fascinated by that era since I was in high school, probably. My parents, you know, came of age in the 60s. They weren't necessarily a part of the counterculture or anything
right.
too exciting. Uh-huh. But they listened to the music, and I've just grown up with it. And in high school, I really became fascinated with the history. And I think maybe that era's history is what drew me into life as a historian. I just wanted to know more about the day-to-day and what that actually looked like.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll start with Bob here on this one. In your opinion, what's one of the biggest events of 1968, in not only during your research, but even just what you knew of that era before you started diving into things, what, in your opinion, is one of the biggest events in 1968 that people should learn more about?
Well, nationally, I guess I would point to Chicago and
the Democratic National Convention.
The Democratic Convention.
The demonstrators resisted when police attempted to arrest a young man who tried to rip down an American flag. The police fired tear gas canisters. The demonstrators threw them back at the police. It was clear that the battle, Chicago's first real battle of the day, was about to be joined.
But apparently he is outside the hall now. This is the first time in my memory of going to political conventions that the police have come in on the floor, armed as they were, and taken out people who were disputing the checking of credentials. Can you ever remember that, Ed?
No, I don't, John. I followed...
First time in the United States, John.
Back.
Again, this is a time when television is becoming the most important medium for communications. And millions of Americans could see the violence that erupted when police, I mean, it was called a police riot. I mean, and when they beat up young protesters and even journalists inside the convention hall. And I think this really showed the divide, the generation gap, and the political divide that was growing in this country into something that would become a gaping chasm in time.
Yeah, yeah.
So as both of you have backgrounds in journalism, when you saw the Democratic National Convention, could you, like, how amazed were you at what was happening?
It was stunning. The even conservative or conservative-inclined commentators like Walter Cronkite, I believe that Dan Rather was one of those on the floor for him. He was jostled around. Several journalists were bloodied covering the demonstration outside. It was just, as a young journalist, it was, and someone who was really concerned about the war in Vietnam, I'd been discharged from the Air Force just 2 years earlier, and it just was, for young journalists in particular, but even the older men and women I worked with, it was galvanizing. It was like you perceive that we were there trying to tell a story, and to tell the truth, and to have it be it smacked of fascism what was occurring. There was a riveting scene on the floor of the National Convention where Abraham Ribicoff, a Connecticut senator, was denouncing the thuggery in the streets, and Chicago Mayor Richard Daley made an obscene gesture and an anti-Semitic remark, and it was just absolutely. It seems like one of the when you play it back in your mind, like the Zapruder film of Kennedy being shot. It was just riveting.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if today at a national convention people started using anti-Semitic language and going after people? That would be
Shocking.
Be insane. Yeah. That would be unbelievable.
Well, given the lack of civility in popular speech today, it wouldn't be so far-fetched.
Well, did you also feel like at this moment something like this could continue and kind of spread to other political movements and political arenas?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Bob really made a good point that the whole – there was I think one of the chants was the whole world is watching. And from Paris to all points to Manila, all spots all around the world, there was a conflagration. And young people were really feeling empowered. Earlier in that New Hampshire primary, it was the young people who cut their hair, shaved their beards, put on their best dresses to get clean for Gene McCarthy.
Yeah.
And it was a stunning upset.
Yeah. So if you fast forward to today, this is just a random question. Do you feel like, because that particular instance seems like it was so much about how both sides were not really civil with each other, there wasn't a lot of good conversation coming out of there. Do you feel like we are in that same space today where civility or the ability to disagree politically is we're at that same sort of fragile moment where we're going to be at each other's throats like they were in 1968, specifically at that convention?
I'll let Bob go first. He's been a working journalist.
I absolutely see both parallels and potential
yeah.
for some kind of a rerun, if you will.
Right, right.
Of that. I mean, one can only imagine the next national political conventions and protesters coming, you know,
right.
in force.
Right.
And the way things are going, who wouldn't be surprised if they were met with force?
Yes.
The one thing that may be a little different
yeah.
is Richard Daley, the Chicago mayor,
right.
Was kind of a hardliner, law and order type of guy. And I think the mayors of major cities today tend to be of a different stripe politically
okay.
for
right.
complex reasons. But
right.
but we see many more liberal mayors, even you know, people of color who are mayors of the major
right.
cities. So I think that's what's different, but I certainly see all kinds of parallels and potential
yeah.
for
yeah.
disorder.
Yeah.
And for like for anybody who's young now in entering the politics and having these kinds of protests and thoughts and saying things out there in social media, do you guys see parallels between now with how we approach social media and what we say and how we behave compared to 1968 and how they were kind of like pushed up against a wall?
Yeah, what's the equivalent to hashtag in 1968? Yeah.
It was still a pound sign.
Right, yeah, okay, cool. So what about you, Lori? What when you were doing the research and you were looking into 1968, what is one of the events that jumped out to you that you felt like really defined the year?
Oh, there's just so much going on. There's so much going on in yeah. Washington State.
In 1968, it was still legal to discriminate in housing in the city of Seattle. it was not their activists had been trying for years to pass a so-called open housing
yeah.
law
yeah.
in a deeply segregated Seattle, and the politicians basically ducked the decision. Put it on the ballot. And in 1964, the voters of Seattle, by more than 2-1,
yeah.
said no to open housing.
Wow.
Said yes to discrimination.
Wow.
But
nice job, progressive voters.
Yeah.
Way to go, Seattle.
It was a different Seattle.
yeah.
But things changed in 1968.
Yeah.
Well, in 1967, some reformers, young reformers, were elected to the city council.
Right.
Including Sam Smith, who had been a state lawmaker
mm-hmm.
and a champion of the open housing law. At the state level.
Yeah.
And so with Sam and a few others, they finally pushed through the open housing law and ended official
wow.
discrimination in Seattle
wow.
housing.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. If I recall correctly, San Francisco had passed a similar vote a year earlier. Either San Francisco or Los Angeles also had overturned open housing.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about you, John? I'm sure you've got a bunch, but what's one of the events that stuck out for you in 1968?
I got to cover a remarkable African-American candidate for a lieutenant governor named Art Fletcher. Mm-hmm. Art came to Washington in 1966 as a civil rights worker for the East Pasco Self-Help Cooperative and was elected to the Pasco City Council. He was a classic progressive Republican. In fact, in Kansas, where he'd been, he was a standout in football for Washburn University in Topeka. He was deprived of being an All-American by only one fact, the color of his skin. He came to Washington State and was recruited in 1968 by Sam Reed, former Secretary of State, to run for lieutenant governor on a ticket with
wow.
Dan Evans, the governor, with Slade Gorton, who was running for attorney general, and A. Ludwell Kramer, another secretary of state,
yeah.
very progressive.
Yeah.
Fletcher, had he been elected,
yeah.
would have been our first ever black statewide elected official. 50 years
wow.
later, we still have yet to elect an African-American to statewide political office.
Here in Washington
Here
State.
Here in Washington State. And the thing that
wow.
he was narrowly defeated down the stretch. He
yeah.
won the primary, narrowly defeated by a racist screed that was published by a right-wing Birch Society-funded paper
yeah.
in Yakima.
Yeah.
And it was just I got to cover Art. He was a big guy with a booming laugh and all sorts of charisma.
Mm-hmm.
But to look back on the racism that was endemic
yeah.
in 1968 and how far we've come, that what if there is really resonates with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have a question for each of you. So think about it and go with it. Name one person or national figure, Washingtonian, who interested you the most and why.
I would say Dan Evans.
Okay.
Talk about what ifs. Dan Evans was running for a second term as governor. He was a classic, what we would call today a mainstream Republican. He kind of bristles at the label liberal because it's sort of been overused and is just that labeling.
Sure.
But he, in taking office in 1965, the first thing Evans did was to read the John Birch Society out of the Republican Party in Washington State. It was incredibly, made headlines around the nation, was an incredibly bold move. And in 1968, he was the keynoter at the Republican National Convention. To set the stage there, Richard Nixon, the new Nixon, the comeback Nixon, was running on a platform.
New and improved Nixon.
The new, I don't know improved, but the allegedly new, was running for president, his second chance. And his platform in all this cataclysm of 1968 was law and order.
That's right.
Law and order. So it came down a key to a vice presidential pick. Dan Evans was, besides being the keynoter, he was on the short list for vice president.
Oh, wow.
Nixon, after meeting with Strom Thurmond and the southern wing of the party, settled on Thomas Spiro Agnew, the largely unknown governor of Maryland, as a sop to the southern wing.
Mm-hmm.
And the what if is, what if Dan Evans had been selected with his probity and his progressive views? Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that had Evans become vice president, he might have jawboned Nixon into telling the truth about Watergate,
mm-hmm.
or if he couldn't have protected Nixon from his demons, that Evans would have been in position to become president of the United States mm-hmm. rather than Gerald Ford.
Yeah, so, yeah.
It's fascinating.
Interesting. I do feel like maybe Evans dodged a bullet, though, because, you know, things did not go well for the Nixons.
No, yeah. But
he could have become president.
Could have become president, absolutely.
Yeah. But he has a legacy here now.
Yeah. So what about you, Lori? What name a national figure who interested you the most and why?
National figure would be Janis Joplin.
Okay. Right on. This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I know...
what a good choice.
Yeah. Janis has intrigued me since I was a girl. Her truth-telling, her honesty, mm-hmm. the way she put words together...
Mm-hmm.
And the soul that she had for a white lady.
Now, did she die in 1968?
No, she died in 70.
Okay.
She became really popular in 67 after the Monterey Pop Festival.
Yeah,
so by 68, Janis is really rocking.
Big time.
Yeah. Right. A Piece of My Heart, I believe, is released in 68.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my national figure for
All
sure.
All right. I like it. How about you, Bob?
Well, can I go Washington? Or I mean,
you
my
can
national,
go wherever you want,
my
sir.
National figure.
Washington's in the country.
Fact.
Yeah, that's a fact.
I'm going to see if I can sneak in
geographical
two, maybe.
Fact.
But quickly, I mean, national figure, I think it would be Walter Cronkite. A former journalist.
Very cool.
You know, he was the most trusted man in America.
Yeah.
And he had been a supporter of the war. And after the Tet Offensive was launched, he went to Vietnam and did reporting on the ground himself, came back and said he thought that the optimism that had been coming out of the Pentagon was unwarranted, that a stalemate was the best outcome probably we could hope for, and we better get to negotiating.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
And the President Johnson, supposedly, there's a dispute around this, but supposedly said something effective, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost America. Something to that effect. And while the war carried on for another 6 years, no year was as deadly for U.S. As 1968. No year was even close. By the early 70s, the casualties had really dwindled. I do think he had an impact in turning the tide. Mm-hmm. Johnson himself dropped out of the presidential reelection bid shortly after that. And then I have a cheat here a little. In Washington, everybody was so inspiring. I got to write about Tom Robbins, who really embodied the altered states of America.
Yeah.
But my favorite was Polly Dyer, who was just a citizen activist, and one of the bright spots of 1968 amid all this darkness was the creation of our third national park in Washington, the North Cascades National Park. Yeah. And Polly was a founder of the local group that spearheaded that.
Mm-hmm.
And she was known for what might be a little different than today.
Mm-hmm.
She was known for her cheerful tenacity and ability to get along with all kinds of people without sacrificing her ideals.
Yeah.
And it was a much different time because there wasn't social media.
Right.
And her home became kind of an academy for this budding environmental movement. It wasn't even – we didn't even have that term, environmentalism, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so Polly was a tremendously social person, and we didn't have email. We didn't have computers and texting and all of that, and it had to be done face-to-face, and people had to be gathered together to stuff envelopes and lick stamps. And she had this amazing legacy over 50 years that I could go on and on about, but we ought to name something after her.
Yeah, there you go. So my dad – I've asked my dad this question before. And this is
I'm afraid to ask how old your dad is.
This is for the two gentlemen who were alive in 68.
Yeah.
So one of the things my dad starkly remembers, aside from Robert Kennedy being assassinated, because it was a watershed moment for him in terms of, you know, he really thought that Kennedy would make a better president than even his brother.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, neither could I. I totally agree with that. So one of the things, the other thing he talked about was the jarring imagery of the Tet Offensive during that time. It was he really distinctly recalls right at the front of his brain the fact that they would do body counts every night on the national news. The Vietnamese lost 1,000 people. We lost 100 people. Is that something you guys remember being pretty distinct during that time period? That feels like that alone wouldn't just turn public opinion today if we had something like that happen. It would outright create the same amount of rioting that happened at that time.
Well, I vividly remember in 1969 and 1970 as a reporter doing stories with fathers, mothers who had lost sons in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Having served in the military during the early years of the Vietnam era, but never going to Vietnam, I can tell you the story that blew us all away in Legacy Washington this year. We set out to find someone who had served in Vietnam and saw real combat. We found a guy in Lewis County, a retired Weyerhaeuser forester named Brian Laux, who was a Green Beret combat medic. But more than that, he was in a super secret special forces group that operated doing counterinsurgency reconnaissance work along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a lot of time in Cambodia. It's a remarkable...
Whoa, we weren't there, though. I just want to let you know
exactly.
That. That's the official line.
There were no incursions,
incursions. I don't know what you're talking about.
When we found Brian Laux, he was at first, like many of the guys I've interviewed and women as well who service women, he was reluctant to talk about it. But he shared with us a first-person account that he had written. I read it and showed it to Bob and Lori, and we were all just moved by the power of it. We thought that with a little editing, we could have just run it verbatim, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted us to blend in an overview of the losses in Vietnam, to put a human face on these body counts, the names on the wall, not far from us.
Right.
And so we did that, and it's tremendously moving. We found out in doing that research that the last person to die, one of the last 15 soldiers to die in Vietnam, was from Washington State.
Wow!
In a rescue mission off the coast of Cambodia to rescue some hijacked sailors. And it by putting a human face on this, and I spent several hours just staring at the names on that wall, mm-hmm. and I knew several of them. But the thing that was fascinating about Brian Laux is that his mentor and hero in Vietnam, the guy who taught him how to stay alive, how to the lore of where to pitch your tent,
yeah.
in almost the sort of stuff about using crickets to detect people, and they used dried bamboo to figure out who might be approaching when they heard the crunch.
Oh, wow.
But his mentor was in a tremendous firefight, gave up his seat to an indigenous member of his team in a helicopter extraction, and lost his life,
mm-hmm.
giving his life and received posthumously the Congressional Medal of Honor, and it just ties it together so amazingly.
Yeah,
Bob remarked on something that that Brian had related to me, that there's been some stories about returning servicemen being spat on and mm-hmm. reviled and called baby killers. And there was one piece that even set out to debunk that, saying that if it ever happened, it wasn't widespread.
Yeah.
But I can tell you from the hours that I've spent with mm-hmm. Brian that he's not a guy who fabricates things.
Yeah.
And he came home on a burial detail. It was in the Los Angeles airport and was spat upon by mm-hmm. A cluster of people who and reviled. And There also, I found just the other day in adding to this story, a really solid account in the New Yorker magazine about families of deceased servicemen who are mm-hmm. harassed.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, my uncle would absolutely disagree with the stories that said it didn't happen. He said the same thing. And I always asked him, like, what do you want? What would you have wanted back then? And he was really pretty honest. He just said, I would have just been fine with welcome home. Thanks for coming back.
There were no,
and that just never happened.
No ticker tape parades.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I have seen pictures of events in Seattle
yeah.
where troops were welcome home
yeah.
in parade-like fashion. It's not that it never did happen.
Right, right.
But I certainly, you know, it was eye-opening because I was skeptical about those reports. I couldn't imagine somebody taking out, you know, they're taking protest in that form. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Brian's story is so amazing and it's so imbued with valor and humanity and intelligence that I certainly believe his account. I just, to your earlier question, Philip, I just want to note that in 1968, I was a 13-year-old living in the Philippines on a Navy
base.
Whoa,
okay.
And, what I saw, so I lived in something of a cocoon mm-hmm. in terms of
yeah.
What the news we got. We didn't
right.
have television there.
Yeah.
We had the Stars and Stripes military
right.
newspaper.
Yeah.
And so we got kind of the good view of things. But even at 13, I could recognize that I would see Marines and sailors with that kind of thousand-yard stare,
yeah, yeah.
you know, you could
yeah.
tell that they just they
saw some things
they
that
weren't
were,
right. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
When we came home in 1969, what's called home leave, like a vacation,
mm-hmm.
We landed in Los Angeles, and it was like the world had changed. It had kind of like gone from black and white to color.
Yeah.
There were all these long-haired guys
right.
in
yeah.
buckskin jackets.
Yeah.
And
it was just a different culture.
The counterculture had just come alive, and we had been kind of insulated.
Yeah.
from that
yeah.
In the Philippines. And we depended on the new people who were transferred in to bring the records and
yeah.
the Jimi Hendrix records and
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah.
So. Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
We kind of hit on it a little bit. In a couple of the exposés you talk about. So how many Washingtonians are highlighted in this particular exhibit that is coming out?
Is Brian in the exhibit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All there's 16 in all.
16 plus Jimmy.
Yep.
16 plus Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, Jimi Hendrix, obviously.
Absolutely. They're all Washingtonians.
So you've hit on a couple here. And are those your favorites? What are some other Washingtonians that you highlighted here in this particular exhibit?
Well, we did one that's sort of like nostalgic catnip to anyone who was listening to rock and roll or growing up in the 60s, and that's Pat O'Day, the legendary disc jockey
on
KJR Seattle Channel 95.
KJR Seattle Channel 95. There we go.
That's fabulous. The central thing was that on February 13th, 1968, Jimi Hendrix came back to Seattle, a Garfield kid. He was not yet an international superstar. He was on the brink of that, but he made his homecoming concert at Seattle Center Arena, and he'd asked Pat to arrange an appearance for him at his alma mater, Garfield. And that was on. Unfortunately, that came on the cold gray dawn of the morning after of Jimmy partying hard all night after the concert. So by the time he got there, he was. Pat said that he seemed like he was nervous. That here was a guy appeared before hundreds of thousands of people, cut records, and there he was in a gymnasium with a bunch of high school kids at his old high school, and it kind of freak out's not the way I put it, but he was sheepish, and it was.
That's interesting.
So he left. He left sort of abruptly without receiving the honorary diploma he was supposed to get.
Oh, really?
And it's really a great story. Yeah. Pat O'Day was not just a DJ, but a concert promoter. Mm-hmm. He was reviled by some of the cognoscenti of the new left and the crowd that thought that Elvis and Roy Orbison and the and Jan and Dean. One of the articles that I read in an underground paper called Helix referred to the Beach Boys as empty-headed crowd pleasers, and wouldn't be long before Brian Wilson was putting out a masterpiece of an album in Pet Sounds.
Yeah, so.
But
Pet Sounds.
Pat saw it all, and fascinating guy.
Yeah. How about you, Lori?
My favorite would be Dr. Maxine Mims.
Oh, yeah.
She's someone I'm really excited to bring to life. She grew up in Virginia under the Negro Improvement Movement by her grandparents and parents. Dad did not let his children ride the public buses. They speed walked everywhere because he didn't want them to be exposed to any sort of humiliation. Mm-hmm. So a very, very proud woman. And she calls her PhD a PhD. She is an educator through and through. And John and I had the privilege of celebrating her 90th birthday, which took place at the Evergreen State College in Tacoma. Mm-hmm. Because Dr. Mims is the founder of that. Mm. She was working as a new instructor at the Evergreen in Olympia, which was a new, brand new college, definitely coming out of the 1960s. And she was living in Hilltop in Tacoma and looking around at her own community, realizing that there wasn't access to a higher education. There was community college, but there were no public institutions nearby for a working minority adult to get an education. So she started at her kitchen table, and it just grew and grew and grew, and now it's a campus. 2,700 graduates.
Yeah.
Thanks
wow. Okay.
Mims.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So there's a lot more to her story. But in 1968, she was working for Seattle Public Schools under the Civil Rights Act.
Uh-huh.
So she was teaching teachers how to work with minority students, how to learn about their communities and their culture and provide better access to education.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. That's a good one. How about you, Bob?
Well, my favorite Washingtonians are my teammates who have brought my work to
look at you
to
knowing
life.
Where your bread is buttered.
And, okay, the probation's off.
No, I just particularly want to note our less celebrated teammates.
Yeah, the peanut gallery over here.
Laura Mott and Amber Rainey, who have just made this work sparkle. And of course, Lori Larson as well is part of that. In both the profiles, how they look in their electronic form, and then the panels for our exhibit that just really evoke the 60s. As for the subjects, I keep trying to get a twofer here.
Yeah, I know. Getting greedy, Bob.
I would have to say that, I mean, a story that's so inspiring is the story of Ralph Monroe, who we know as know best as a five-term Secretary of State. But when Ralph was a young man and kind of a little bit aimless, well, that's not the right word. His career path was uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
He happened to chip in and help on a event for children with disabilities, and at this party on a boat, a holiday party on a boat, he noticed this one boy sitting alone quietly amidst all this boisterous partying and pictures with Santa, and Ralph ended up befriending this boy, Terry Sullivan, who didn't talk, and with Ralph's help, Terry did begin to speak. More importantly, Ralph made a connection with Governor Evans. Governor Evans made him the head of volunteerism for the state. And then Ralph would get Terry, this young boy, in front of the governor at every opportunity to remind him of the plight of thousands of children. And all kinds of advances began to be made because, in part, the disability rights movement got under the civil rights movement umbrella and really expanded that way. And all kinds of things flowed from that, like our revolutionary education for all law that requires that the state educate every child, has a responsibility to educate every child, whereas we had some really archaic laws on the books that said children with loathsome contagious diseases like cerebral palsy, which, so that's not even an accurate description,
right.
You know, were not entitled to this kind
wow.
of thing. And I think the kind of exclamation point on all of this is after Education for Law was passed, Governor Evans said it didn't take money, it didn't take lobbyists, which they didn't have. It took citizens who cared, which is kind of the overarching theme, I think, for 1968.
Yeah.
So many people got active and ended up accomplishing so much.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like we had a third party in 1968. I feel like there was Democrats, there was Republicans, and then there were like revolutionaries from both from both parties, because you could argue Bobby Kennedy was not really a Democrat. He was like a centrist Democrat. He was just different. And then to hear about Ralph Monroe, I feel like we had a different, active, like, subset of people in each party that we may not see that much today. What do you think about that?
I have some really bad news for you, Phil.
Yeah?
There was a very active third party candidate in 1968, and that was George Wallace.
Oh, no, I didn't mean him.
No, I know. I know, but he carried several states.
Yeah,
and when we talked earlier about Spiro Agnew being picked as the vice presidential candidate on the GOP ticket, that was in no small part, an effort to try to undermine the Wallace strength in the Deep South.
Right.
But you're right. There was you could make a case that there was an emerging new coalition of whatever we want to label them, and we're all should be leery of labeling, but progressives and the like. Eugene McCarthy easily could have formed a third party.
Right.
John Anderson later, a decade later, founded sort of a middle-of-the-road progressive farmer labor roots kind of thing. But the Wallace candidacy in 1968 and again in 1972.
That's wild, by the way, that sort of candidacy is like
He did very well in Washington State.
Yeah, he won states.
Yeah. He didn't win Washington State, but he did very well here.
I know.
So
it's wild. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's so interesting. All that stuff. Like the fact that I think Wallace won, he won like six states, didn't he, in the South?
Could have been millions of votes.
Yeah. But for listeners who aren't familiar with George Wallace, who is the former governor of Alabama. Wasn't it he who said segregation now,
segregation forever?
And he represented views that are very vocal in today's America as well.
He staked out law and order and a nativist thing about immigration. And
wasn't he at the door when they were attempting to integrate Alabama University? He stood up like he was some
Blocked
sort of hero or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That to me, that is mind blowing in and of itself. That he's able to basically, he becomes a power player politically on the national
like
stage.
Like a folk hero.
Yeah, yeah, for real.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay.
Is that allowed?
Wait, whoa. We have to discuss this.
We'll allow it.
We'll allow it.
Okay. Everybody gets one.
Yeah. Would you say that Washington state politics really becomes more progressive in what we know today starting in...
Excellent question. You sure you haven't hosted a show?
She could.
Yeah, right? Good question.
I think it is. I think that the Crucible of 1968... has made Washington politics more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by looking at what Evans, Gorton, Kramer, and Fletcher did, one of the things that's really interesting here is there's a well-known Seattle public opinion pollster, Stuart Elway.
Mm-hmm.
And Stuart Elway in 1968 was a junior at the University of Washington. It was part of this youth movement that got behind that ticket of Evans, Fletcher, Kramer,
mm-hmm.
Gorton. And they started out, it was Sam Reed, who was a young Evans aide, and a young Harvard-educated Seattle lawyer named Christopher Bailey. And mm-hmm. they formed something called Action for Washington.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted it to be bipartisan. But because, in particular, Lud Kramer and Evans and Fletcher were so charismatic as progressives, it largely became a mainstream young Republican movement. Mm. And the changes that were happening at the University of Washington then, that with the Black Student Union, the Panthers, feminism coming into its mm-hmm. own, one of the profiles here is former U.S. Congressman Norm Dix from Bremerton.
Oh, yeah.
36 years, 18 terms, pretty amazing. He came to the University of Washington in 1960 as a freshman, and in 1968, when he departed with a law degree to go to work for Senator Warren Magnuson, he saw in the space of that 8 years an absolute sea change in the university as an institution, mm-hmm. in America on just in the crucible of change. In particular, I was struck, if you look at, I like looking at high school annuals and college annuals, mm-hmm. because they really reflect their times. And if you look at 1960 with all the rah-rah and hula hoop contests and sweethearts of Sigma Chi versus 1968 with young people, black, white, yellow, marching mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. civil rights. And Bob, we found out a fascinating statistic that we tracked down about how many minority students there were at the University of Washington. And I think that what we pinpointed, the statistics were a will-o'-the-wisp, but there were about 200 black students mm-hmm. at the university in 1968 when the Black Student Union held its occupied President Odegaard's office.
Mm.
Out of a student body of 30,000.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, only 20 Native Americans and even fewer Latinos at the time.
Yeah,
The good news is by the next fall,
absolutely.
They seem to be producing results.
Right.
And we've seen in 68, the UW student population was almost 96% white.
Uh-huh.
In 2018, it's 44% white.
Wow. So there has been real genuine progress.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. What about you? Do you think that 68 essentially pointed Washington in a specific direction?
Yeah. I'm going to just take the Seattle slice, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
In the political legacy of 1968 kind of came to bloom in the next year when Wes Ullman was elected mayor of Seattle, just 34 years old, the first Democrat, first Democratic mayor in Seattle in three decades.
Wow.
Think about that.
Yeah.
And I would argue that Seattle has turned irretrievably leftward since West became
yeah, because it would seem like that mayor. same stat will be like the for Republicans now, the first Republican mayor in like 40 years
right,
or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And so West himself was kind of hard to pin down and I think often described as a centrist Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a firebrand by any stretch.
Sure.
He was a son of a Pentecostal a minister. He was in the Army Reserves. He had been a real estate attorney. But he really was a politician of the times. Mm-hmm. And after his election, or under Wes Ullman, Seattle saw its first bumper shoot festival, its first mayoral proclamation for Gay Pride Week, the Burke Gilman Trail, the salvation of Pioneer Square and Pike Place Market, the King Dome was built. The number of minorities who were in the city workforce were doubled. The first black department heads came under Ullman. Ullman created the Office of Women's Rights and the Women's Commission. And it just goes on and on. I mean, even in his first couple months, he right away kind of planted the flag by proclaiming Cesar Chavez first citizen of Seattle. Yeah. He flew flags at half-mast for the Kent State protesters who were killed by the National Guard. And then he opened up the express lanes on the freeway to allow all these protesters spilling out of the U District to march downtown.
Yeah.
On and on. And there's a great story, I have to say, in our profile of Wes about how the federal government, specifically Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, wanted his help in raiding the local Black Panthers. And Wes said defiantly no.
Wow.
And this had repercussions with the White House. And there's a great showdown that occurs in the White House, told by one of the witnesses to it, Norm Dix, who does so, as John noted, with his characteristic relish and maybe a little spicy mustard, too.
So you guys are clearly invested in this project with all the research, the interviewing of subjects, and then the designing of the exhibit. So what do you hope that people can learn when they come and they see it, when they experience anything online? What do you hope that people take away?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that we're taking... But the very nature of being on this program, podcasting, social media, but the exhibit itself, which opens September 13th here at the state capitol and at the Office of the Secretary of State, features these large panels that are as skillfully done as anything you'll see in the Smithsonian or any other
media. There you go. Give them some credit.
Well, they deserve it.
Yeah,
they're really talented. And
you, Smith, you're right. You're Smithsonian's calling you next. Don't discount that.
We've been paid heavily for
you've been
rewarded. No,
I think they call that a bribe.
Yeah,
John.
Bribe. Yeah. That's the word I was searching for. These Amber and Lori have done a remarkable job, not just with this exhibit, but as when we really hit our stride here, we did an exhibit and a series of profiles on who are we, about the diversity of Washington State, about World War II veterans, about Korean War veterans. And Lori said in the introduction about what is Legacy Washington, our mandate is to write about former statewide elected officials, members of Congress, members of the judiciary, but then Senator Sam Hunt and Sam Reed, when they codified this program, put in this other codicil talking about other Washingtonians from all walks of life who've made a political contribution to the history of the state.
Yeah.
A Vietnam veteran, a civil rights worker. So we have these exhibit panels that are really arresting, and that people of all ages, young people in particular. We've had a feature here where the kids in particular can write down a question or an observation. We've collected those. It's really neat. So we've also began working with the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction to develop curriculum that makes this all the more relevant. But a key component of this that the taxpayers ought to know is that we don't use state funds for the exhibits per se, or for the books that we publish that derive from this. So Lori and Amber, Lori in particular overseeing it, there's a lot of really creative fundraising that has, besides just passing the hat, has the effect of engaging people, the League of Women Voters, the Daughters of the American Revolution, UW Alumni Association. So we're taking a really multimedia, trying to, forgive me for saying it, a cutting-edge approach to being even more relevant.
Right.
It used to break my heart when my kids came home from the obligatory 8th grade Washington State history class and told me how boring it was.
Right.
Because Washington State history is anything but boring. Mm-hmm. these colorful characters. And
the one thing I will say about the exhibits every time is first of all, they are they're always unique year over year. So the World War II exhibit, for those who have ever seen it, was cleaner. It was, you know, big, huge, sort of rectangular, very, very like neat and put together. The Korean War the Korean War exhibit has much more, like, it's frenetic and it's the information is all over the place. You're kind of looking and you're finding these nooks and crannies. And then I can't imagine what 1960, it's got to be like a tie-dyed situation. So, Lori, what about you? What do you hope people learn from this exhibit?
I just hope people really take away that modern Washington is born out of this era and think about what has happened in the 50 years since.
Yeah.
Well, maybe in the future.
Ah, yeah. That's great.
But it's really a reflection in a lot of ways of what's going on today.
Wow, great.
She really put it great.
Yes, she did. Modern Washington, I think she might have put it better than you, sir.
Well, she certainly did. Modern modern Washington was really born in 1968.
Yeah.
Politically, emotionally, civil rights.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really great.
I think what I hope people would learn is the power of the individual to make a difference. I go back to what Governor Evans said about citizens who care. I go to what Ralph Monroe said, that if people would just go volunteer at their local school instead of thinking they can find the solution in a spa in Palm Springs, they'd be a lot better off.
Yeah.
And I think also there's – despite all the turbulence, there's reason for optimism. Tom Robbins, one of our subjects, the acclaimed novelist who went off, left Seattle's distractions and went to Pacific County to write his first novel that year, Another Roadside Attraction, is remarkably optimistic about our future.
Yeah.
And he's seen a lot. And I think this is perhaps best summed up by Twyla Carter, who's a Washingtonian. Grew up in Medical Lake, and she's now senior staff attorney for the ACLU in New York. And so she considers two of our subjects, Larry Gossett and Lem Howell, both mentors. So I called Twyla, and she told me she had just briefed a new group of interns at the ACLU. And she said to them, I don't care what law school you went to. Actually, she said it in a more profane way.
Yes.
she said, what matters is that you have the courage of your convictions. And she said, that's what Lem and Larry have. And that's the thread that runs through all these individuals. Mm-hmm. They had the courage of their convictions and they made a difference.
I like that. And I like ending on positive notes. That's way better. I like that. These two blew you out of the water on that answer. I'm sorry, John. If I'm giving points.
Very much expected.
I'm sorry. If I'm giving points. Yeah. basically, let's talk about, so you mentioned when it opens. When does the exhibit open officially?
September 13th.
September 13th.
3 p.m. in the reception room.
And the public is welcome to come and view
Absolutely.
It on September 13th?
We're hoping to rock the rotunda.
Rock the rotunda. Excellent. Nice. You guys will also have a pretty healthy web component with this too, right? Lots of stories will be on the Legacy website.
They're being rolled out over the next several weeks. Okay. Three are up already, Polly Dyer, Pat O'Day, Ralph Monroe. And there'll be blog posts previewing those. And then on September 13th, everything will be, the long form stories are all online for free.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you, John. And thank you to everybody from Legacy Washington for being here, talking a little bit about the exhibit. Fantastic stuff. The website you can go to if you're interested more in Legacy Washington is www.sos.wa.gov/legacy. And, of course, they'll have the exhibit ready in September. And we want to thank Legacy for coming out and appreciate everything. We'll see you guys later. Rock on, Washington.